this is Carlo's Bakery. Sugar. Every week, thousands of cakes and pastries go out these doors. Sugar, sugar. This is the crew, Mia Familia. Sugar. We're gonna take this bakery to the top. They call sugar, me sugar. Buddy. I'm the boss. Sugar.
It's Chapo.
We're back.
The core of four.
The gang of four.
The gang of four. Me, Felix, Brendan, Matt. Fellas, feels like it's been a while. Yeah. We haven't done anything since the live show we did on Thursday. So it's time to, you know, shake that dust off and get back into the swing of things. And, you know, sort of the 5 days to a week we've had off has given me some time to think and reflect on the course of the show, and I'm proud to announce we're going in a new direction.
Okay.
Chapo Trap House is going to be a show dedicated exclusively to recapping every episode of Cake Boss, starting with season one, episode one, titled, Hey, I'm the Cake Boss.
For those of you who don't know, Cake Boss is a show. It's about an Italian-American man, and he's not content.
And
just
his familia.
His familia.
In season one, episode one, Buddy the Cake Boss has to make a very special cake for a very special bar mitzvah boy who loves basketball. And they're going to get really conceptual and metaphorical by making a cake that looks like a basketball.
Hey, we're making a basketball cake. It's going to be a basketball. Hey, Cake Boss.
Cake Boss is great because it shows vividly why the state of New Jersey needs to be condemned.
No, it shows vividly why small business owners are heroes and the backbone of America.
Yeah. There's a whole dramatic arc where it's going to snow, and he's terrified of the snow and what it'll do to business.
I don't know what's going to snow. Oh, my God.
And then the mayor comes around. I think, Felix, you were like, he thinks the mayor is in charge of the weather.
Oh, hey, your majesty. Look, I know you got a job to do, but could you hold off on the snow for a day? Yeah, we like to think, and this is probably true, the Cake Boss has no object permanence.
Yes.
He doesn't know how weather works. He doesn't know what happens to the sun when it's night out. Mm-hmm. No Italian person does, actually.
We saw one episode where a set of twins came in to get a birthday cake for their mother.
Yeah.
And we were fantasizing that Cake Boss sees a set of twins and he's like, ooh, I don't know how this magic trick works.
He
keeps looking for the mirror. He's like,
which one's the real one?
Also, another sort of subtle plot that unravels throughout the season is he keeps getting a darker and darker spray tan.
Yeah.
Until it's not acceptable.
He looks Lebanese by the end of the season.
Yes. So there's this one episode where every time they cut to an interview portion, he gets darker and darker.
His forehead.
His forehead is like totally black at one point.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that's the secret to blackface, okay? You go by a little bit every day.
Yeah.
And so by the time that you're at week seven, you got the full blackface on, but no one notices because it's like getting into a pool slowly.
And then the one we watched last night, it featured one of the cakes that they were making was for a female bodybuilder. And when they go to the party to show her, she's just in black, all black body, black face, like bronze to the point of
it was beyond
like
bronze.
A black woman, basically.
Yeah. It was absurd.
Yeah. That's actually why so many people in New Jersey get into bodybuilding.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the new show. I hope you guys like it.
Sure.
The Cake Boss. Chapo Cake Boss.
It's me, the Cake Boss. At the end of every episode.
Just kidding, friends. This is Chapo Classic right now. This is the original. This is the Gang of Four Chapo Classic. And what we're going to do on today's show is one massive fucking drive-by duck hunt on the New York fucking Times. And they're just atrocious stable of cretins who populate their op-ed page, starting with the latest edition, one Brett Stevens. Okay, this happened, like, you know, this has sort of been going on for a week now that the Times hired him away from the Wall Street Journal, or, you know, and I got a lot to speak on this. I have fucking hated this creep forever. Again, Google image search him, look up his dumb smug baby face, and try to imagine what'll happen first: him growing a beard or us going to war with Iran. One of them he has control over.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, Brett Stevens is one of those Never Trump guys. He's one of the guys who's like, actually, sir, I'm a conservative in the tradition of Burke, Mega Man, and Gary Glitter. And for whatever reason, we're rewarding neocons now. I don't know why they seem to exactly get us to the point we're at with so much of their bullshit, but specifically because they're not Trump, because Bret Stephens doesn't just flat out speak in overt racism or any of that.
Actually, he does.
He does.
For the right group of people.
Yeah, right. But you could still do that to Arabs.
Yes.
Yeah. But we're rewarding them for some reason. We're giving him a big fat contract at the New York Times. And boy, did he throw himself a welcome party.
No, I mean, it makes sense, though. I mean, it's not like neoconservatism just got completely pantsed and owned and shown to be completely irrelevant and wildly reviled even among the Republican voter base. I mean, this is still a vital and important political ideology. Any of the fucking shithead libs who read New York Times, I like to find out what's going on in the conservative world. Like, guess what? None of it is Bret Stephens tut-tutting about fucking climate change. It's Steve Bannon reading Camp of the Saints and fucking putting sharpened punji stakes in front of his house to keep refugees away.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is like the sort of the controversy that arose over this was that what people latched onto was that Bret Stephens is a climate change denialist. Previously in the Wall Street Journal, he's compared, people who, environmentalists or people who like don't think that people like him or, should be given, these platforms to spout this nonsense. He's compared them to like basically Stalin and Hitler and an attack on his free speech. And that's exactly what he's doing now. But what I think is interesting is I think this like, for the New York Times audience, I think it's funny that like they latched on to his climate change opinions rather than literally everything else he said and done, which I got to say, look, the climate change denialism is grotesque, but let's be honest, there's probably nothing we can do about it at this point anyway. I mean, his whole thing is like, he doesn't even deny it. If you read his column, he says like, I can see that it is true and it is man-made, but like, I basically don't want to do anything about it, or that like I don't want to make any we shouldn't allow any policy that'll basically interfere with global capitalism in any way or impede anyone's ability to like keep making billions of dollars.
Well, hold on a minute, it was his first article. Like he the shit about Arabs is all in his back pocket, but like his shot out of the gate was, "Hi everybody, rising sea levels are cool and bay and fleek." So and I mean. It will fucking kill us all. I mean, it'll kill everyone. So for me, it is the worst thing. And like I said, it's the first thing he came out of the barrel with.
Well, I think the point is that reasonable people can disagree on which one of Bret Stephens' opinions marks him as a repellent piece of shit. Matt says it's the global warming. I say it's his unrepentant support of genocidal warmongering. His open support of torture, the fact that he wants to nuke Tehran probably tomorrow. I'm just going to go run through some of his highlights here. You may remember he appeared on stage with the corpse of Sheldon Adelson and Rabbi Shmuley Biotech at one point, during which Adelson's sort of like shambling reanimated corpse that sort of kept moving and vocalizing things through a series of electrical shocks. He was on stage with Adelson, and Adelson recommended that the United States should preemptively engage in a preemptive nuclear strike on Iran to show that we're serious. And Stephen said nothing and just sort of nodded his head sagely. He has referred to Palestinians as basically rabid dogs that need to be culled. He has even said that he actually hates Jewish people, or he says he's glad that he wasn't born not Jewish because he'd be an anti-Semite. You know, so they hire this asshole for no fucking reason. And of course, the defense that the Times proffers from their like public editors or the people in charge of their op-ed page is that, look, we're committed to ideological diversity. And like, you know, why would you get so angry by just having a conservative represented? This is what the op-ed page is. And like, this is the phoniest line of all, because in no way is Bret Stephens' point of view underrepresented on the major op-eds pages of like every major American newspaper.
Yeah.
It's at the Wall Street Journal. It's at the New York Times already in the guise of David Brooks, who's like a slightly softer version of Bret Stephens.
Yeah.
It's certainly all of the Washington Post, Fred Hyatt's shop.
Yeah.
This, you know, sort of hawkish pro-Israel, like neoconservative line that is basically only popular on America's op-ed pages.
Yeah, if you only read op-ed pages, you'd be like, wait, how did Marco Rubio not win every single vote in the Republican primary?
Yeah.
It's the
why are there fucking op-ed pages?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, opinion
Why
writing.
Why do these exist?
No, I mean, like, I think it's funny when people win awards for op-eds. It's like, that's, you're giving someone an award for basically being your uncle that never shuts the fuck up. Can you give someone an award for asking how your day was, for being the best at that? It's just the same, like, nuisance behavior. But
world's greatest dad.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think what's interesting about the Stevens hire is that he is an exceptionally grotesque human being, like an exceptionally rotten and evil person that to, you know, pick out and hire. And, like, look, more than anything, he's an incredibly mediocre writer. Like, that's the thing. It's not like they picked out some, you know, someone with awful opinions who was, like, witty or stylish in any way. Not that any of these people are, but, like, he's exceptionally mediocre in his thinking. And, like, if you read interviews with him, like, he thinks he's very clever when he's just, like, his response, like, Jeff Stein of Vox interviewed him, and his response to, like, the global warming stuff was basically to say, you know, my friend believes in global warming, but he just had a kid. Would that be rational if he really believed in global warming? It's just like he took one class on, like, rational choice theory and then has filtered every opinion through it, which is basically how every dumb person's idea of a smart person talks.
Yeah. It goes along with this talking point about intellectual diversity, which is such a college thing, like a college campus thing, where conservatives are annoyed that they're not represented by the, you know, rest of the libs on student government or in clubs. So then they have their own paper, like the Harvard Salient, or all these little sort of pet projects that they then carry over into their professional lives, that they direct toward the quote unquote mainstream media that doesn't represent them, even though, as we've just discussed, they're well represented on op-ed pages and on TV.
And it's such a narrow band. I will believe that editorial pages are committed to ideological diversity when they give Bob Avakian a call.
I
want Chairman Bob talking about how we need to, like, clear the cities of and have them work in the countryside.
They talk this line of ideological diversity and intellectual diversity, but so the farthest left person that they have on the op-ed page is what, Paul Krugman, a pro-Clinton.
Gail Collins,
great. That's, you don't even have, like, a Sanders Democrat on there. You don't have that. There's no viewpoint for anti-interventionism.
Yeah,
for
fine. Throw Bret Stephens on the Times op-ed page, right? But have just even one person who's anti-Zionist as well.
Yeah.
Or just not even a regular columnist. Run
sure,
a fucking
we'll get
op-ed.
Pat Buchanan
single
on there. If you want Pat Buchanan, we'll put him on. Like, that's what Perrine said a couple episodes ago, is actually the only time you do get some non-interventionist stuff like that is when it's a racist right-winger paleocon.
Right. And I think, like, the Stevens thing I think is worth talking about, because I feel like, sort of, like, as an addendum to our conversation about the West Wing, I think the reaction to it and, like, the defensiveness on, like, the sort of liberal New York Times class, I think really speaks to this fucking brain worm that haunts the fact that they keep making these same mistakes over and over again, I think speaks to something important about their failure of imagination or their failure to recognize the politics that they're engaging in. And I want to read here from two writers who I thought both had very good pieces about the Stevens hire. The first is from Ryan Cooper. He writes here, if the Times were really committed to ideological diversity in its op-ed page, it would at a minimum hire a conservative who actually supports President Trump, and perhaps more importantly, hire someone with a Bernie Sanders style politics. What we see here is the neurotic upper-class liberal need for civil debate over important issues stops the moment we reach territory they actually care about. Trump is gauche and uncouth, and his media proxies tend to be really weird liars. While Sanders wants to jack up the marginal tax rates a whole lot, a rich, glib, dumb, anti-Trump conservative, on the other hand, can give Upper East Side cocktail parties that frisson of intellectual disputation while conveniently avoiding most of the actual important questions. A little climate denial is just a niggling side detail. I think that's exactly right. And I just feel like, you know, this episode is dedicated to hating the New York Times. So I would like to shout out a friend of the show, Twitter user, I Hate New York Times. And I think she gets it exactly right, in that, like, she said something along the lines of that, like, this liberal mentality that we see here, it's they really believe that if they question their most deeply held beliefs, then, well, their opponents must be doing the same thing. And no, they aren't. Because the difference between liberals and conservatives is that, for better or worse, and it's all for worse, conservatives know what they believe in and they know who their enemies are. Liberals don't. And I'm not saying that, like, they don't. I just, like, they have beliefs, you know? like I said, they believe in climate change. They think guns are bad. And I think we should, you know, I think they have a certain sincere belief that racial and sexual minorities shouldn't be, you know, oppressed and should are worthy of respect and full inclusion in our society. But the problem is, all it really amounts to is a set of manners, not really a coherent politics. And as such, they get rolled by these very glib sophists like Bret Stephens, who, of course, are very well trained. They live and work among the NPR mindset, which has sort of, you know, like I said, trained liberals in a certain respect to just sort of like, if you throw them some shit about reasonable discussion, they'll fucking swallow anything. And what you see Bret Stephens doing is, of course, coming in with this, like the climate change is a perfect example, and just being like, look, I'm just asking questions. You're not against that, are you? And then when people get angry or just like, why the fuck is the New York Times gratifying this idiotic bullshit? Then he can play, then they play the victim and they go, oh, you know, for months now, I've been, you know, the target of the derision of the alt-right for my brave stance against President Trump. But now I see the lefties are just even worse.
He also looks like, he reminds me of Clifford, the Martin Short movie. Where he's this boy. Like, he looks like a boy. Yeah. I met him one time inside of the Fox News building, and he just very briefly, and he looks 12 years old, but he has this, you know, deep evil about him that Martin Short does, and the highly underrated comedy Clifford.
Yeah. Clifford is a fucking great movie.
It holds
incredibly
up.
Funny.
But if you even look at me funny, if you do one thing that I find weird, see, you're doing it right now. Can you just act like a human boy for 1 minute here? Look at me like a person. You can't do it for more than a few seconds. Look at me like a human boy.
The big thing for me about Stephens is, like, when you grow up in a sort of certain sphere, you just associate the New York Times with an established paper that it doesn't really fuck up. But for me, they lost their credibility with Iraq, with Judy Miller. And to hire somebody like Stephens is like, it's not just not learning the lesson, because not learning the lesson would be maintaining the same op-ed page they had, where there was no real voice for anti-interventionism, no real voice for anything. Like, any time they've written about Syria or Libya, it's just like the same kind of how dare you, Mr. Assad type bullshit. But hiring such a hard neocon in 2017 is just an aggressive fuck you to everyone. It's a fuck you to the millions of people who were maimed in that war. It's what we should expect from big media conglomerates like this. But
it's also an insult to the millions of half-wit right-wingers who voted for Trump because they thought he was going to be less imperial in his foreign policy, which was a new constituency on the right that emerged as part of this new weird populism. But none of those people are getting a seat at the New York Times column to understand the right. Instead, you get four versions of the same milquetoast weirdos that basically have no constituency at all in the American electorate.
Yes, yeah, as I mentioned, Stephens is just a more hardcore version of David Brooks. They are fundamentally the same person in that neither of them can grow a beard or have penises. I want to read one more just clip here from another writer who I thought did a really good job responding to this, and that's Sarah Jones writing at the New Republic. She says here, it's only possible to hire a writer like Stephens if you have no serious moral or intellectual objections to his views. That is absolutely true. And the editors of the show and the people who run the New York Times do not. They do not have any serious objections to his views. She goes on, the editors of the Times fall back on one axiom and elevate it to the greatest moral standard of all, the need for intellectual diversity. Bennett calls it, James Bennett calls it the free exchange of ideas. Public editor Liz Spade says it's the antidote to a liberal orthodoxy of thought. The paper's deputy washing editor, Jonathan Wiseman, dismissed Stephens' critics as imbeciles who, quote, can't stand a conservative presence. And I'd just like to say to Jonathan, none of us should stand a conservative presence. We shouldn't stand any of these people. Least of all, the fucking paper of record.
Let the fucking Washington Times or Newsmax or Fox News or his old Wall Street Journal pick him back up then. He'll be fine. Yeah. You don't have to pick him up.
Daily Caller signs checks just like the New York Times.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that at least one advantage of Trump winning the nomination would be people going, oh, wait, no one wants to vote for these fucking people anymore. But you're never going to stop a certain type of liberal from living in a fantasy world.
No.
I mean, hiring Stevens and this intellectual diversity bullshit, it's as much of a retreat to fantasy as the Harry Potter shit is.
I promise this isn't a way to get people to a shameless way to get people to subscribe, but I do think our West Wing episode is kind of like the whatever, the Rosetta Stone.
But if they're listening to this one, they have heard
fuck
the West
yeah,
Wing.
Yeah. I'll just cut that out.
Parenthetically, there was that I saw today. Someone showed me there was an interview with Iannucci. Armando Iannucci, who created In the Thick of It and Veep, and he talked about visiting the Obama White House. He was toured by Reggie Love, Obama's body man.
Yeah.
And he said that he related everything that he showed him to the West Wing.
Dude, we're right
like
again.
He would say, okay, this is the conference room. This is where CJ and Charlie would sit.
Oh, God, man.
So, like, he was... Instead of being like, well, I'm the actual fucking guy, this is what it is, he related to his own life and the lives of the other people working in the West Wing through the show. The show was the reality, and they were basically cosplaying, even though they were the actual people.
That's like if you served three tours in Afghanistan with 5th Special Forces, and you're like, it was kind of like that, you know, the G.I. Joe episode where they infiltrate Commander Cobra's lair. By the way, for people who don't know, body man, when the president is a body man, that refers to a bodybuilder that the president hires to inspire him, get bigger around him, and just marvel at his muscles.
So, like, yeah, with Stevens, it's just like, look... The New York Times, for better, like, look, it is the paper of record in America. And a lot of the defense of it is just like, okay, look, someone said, like, some New York Times person was like, look, I don't like Stevens' views on climate change, but if you cancel your subscription, you're canceling your subscription on, like, are the best climate change reporters in the world. And that may be right. The New York Times does have good reporters. Obviously.
Michael Barbaro.
Yeah, Mikey Barbs, of course. Look, obviously, like, the New York Times, even before the Iraq War, like, I'm a big fan of Alexander Coburn and Gore Vidal, and if you read them, they know where all the fucking bodies are buried. This has been a long-time problem, but at the end of the day, the Times still does do good reporting, but they fucking undermine it all with this horrible op-ed page. I guarantee you Brett Stevens is making 10 times more than anyone who's doing the climate beat for them or covering any actual real politics.
Sure.
And it's the same thing with the Wall Street Journal. They had great journalists who would day in and day out report the news in a way that directly contradicted the fucking their vision of its hard right op-ed section and editorial policies.
Yeah.
So, like, it's just they're insulting the intelligence of everybody when they do this shit. And it just shows that, like, at the highest levels, they do not care. They do not care what product they put out. Or if they do, they have such a fucking dim vision of themselves that, like, this is what they actually think is good. Either way, it doesn't fucking matter because it's just it redounds to the ruin of everyone else. So that's Stevens. Like I said, you know, be on the lookout for him to continue to be just an obnoxious shithead day in and day out. I mean, fuck, the New York Times hired Bill Kristol for like 6 or 7 months.
The only reason that didn't work out is because he's so functionally illiterate. Yeah. Like he was all set up to be a Douthat or a Brooks or now a Stevens, and he was just so bad that on a like a functional literary level, they had to get rid of.
Like, Stevens is just as bad as Bill Kristol. Like, he's just as boring and thoughtless in every regard. In my former guise in publishing, I actually read his book proposal for a book that I think ended up being called, like, America Alone or something, that was published by Sentinel, which is some fucking right-wing ghetto for trainables like Dana Loesch or whoever. And yeah, it was one of the laziest book proposals I've ever seen. And it's not like this was like, ooh, you know, good luck getting published as a conservative, as a Republican, and the liberal live right. Because we publish books by fucking Max Boot and David Gerlernter. So, but like Stevens' book proposal was like 8 pages. Half of it was like fucking, I think I seem to remember like half of it being just Xeroxes of his old columns. And then, like, in the meeting, I just kept my mouth shut because I was just, don't say anything. And then was just very pleased to see it fucking die in front of everyone else because they were like, we can't publish. This is just lazy, just hack work, ideological hack work on behalf of the most evil people in the universe.
Yep.
And then he actually apparently got really mad that we didn't even bother to make an offer.
Oh, good.
So that's a little gossip for you. I hope that's okay for me to say at this point, but fuck it. I don't work there anymore. So moving on from Stevens, let's talk about another New York Times columnist. He's favorite of the show.
Legend.
Goat. Ross.
Yeah.
Ross.
The greatest man to ever put on the op-ed jersey.
Raising that jersey to the rafters. Ross Douthat.
He doesn't look as young as Brett Stevens, but he actually is much younger.
He's far younger.
Well, I mean, Brett Stevens, though, one of the reasons he is so anti-Iran is that a Persian wizard put a curse on him when he was young. So he's always going
to look
well.
And he's been cursed to lick a big lolly wherever he goes.
Brett Stevens
imagine my surprise when the tolerant left put me in a child sailor outfit.
Knocked off my pinwheel hat.
Yeah. Spun the propeller on my cap.
Ross was getting horny today. Did you guys see
that?
Oh, hell yeah.
Yes.
That's what we want to talk about.
We'll get to that. The setup for this is Ross, and again, this column speaks exactly to this mentality and to Ross's utter cowardice as a fucking writer. He wrote an article last week in the Sunday opinion section titled, "Is There a Case for Le Pen?" Ross, just write the op-ed piece, The Case for Le Pen, okay?
Yeah.
Why this fucking demure attitude, right? We all know who you're rooting for, Ross, but he has to play footsie with the only people who like really take him seriously are his deluded liberal readers who think that they're like, this is, I'm feeding my mind. I'm feeding my mind a diverse cast of vegetables and opinions.
Yeah. Good sir, would you go to the greatest banquet in the world and only eat dessert?
The piece itself is not even worth reading from. I mean, like, as soon as you saw that title, you know, yeah, no, Ross, just make the case for fucking Le Pen. Have some fucking balls. Like, just, like, this is your job. This is what you get paid six figures to do. And he was just, you know, he had to, in it, he seems to be like, you know, the best line in it actually is he said, you know, Marine Le Pen was, you know, instrumental in distancing, you know, the Front National from the more, you know, strident anti-Semitism and open fascism of her father. And he says, of course, they are positioning for votes. And I just love that, of course, in there. That's always a tell. Like, you know, it's just like, of course they're doing that. You know, this should be taken into consideration. It's like as if you would have a problem with any of their open anti-immigrant.
To be sure. It's a to be sure.
Yeah, to be sure. Yeah. And he's like, and, you know, he also mentions that, you know, many of her anti-immigrant racist views are quite common in French politics. So it's hard to, you know, single her out. And it's just like, well, if everybody's doing it.
Yeah. Why not?
In a way, it's not bad. So Ross is an utter coward, of course. Yeah. But Matt, of course, was referring to this amazing tweet today from Ross that I think is actually the most grotesque thing he's ever written.
Oh, God.
And this surpasses even the Chunky Reese Witherspoon incident or any of the just soul-shatteringly embarrassing moments from Privilege. Doubt That, NYT, today, 5/3/17, 4:34 p.m.
There's context. He was live-tweeting the French presidential debates like an asshole.
One-handed.
Scintillating, yeah. Ross writes, what if Hillary had Le Pen's smoker's voice instead of her own?
What if Le Pen was 15 feet tall and she crushed me under her feet and I just got a mouthful of toe jam and she called me a little worm and rubbed my head into the carpet? What if she strapped me to a radiator and beat me with Hot Wheels tracks until a crucifix formed on my back?
Le Pen is doing breath play with the French electorate at the moment, cutting off their oxygen just enough to make things interesting. Of course, the answer to Ross, if Hillary had Le Pen's smoky Kathleen Turner voice, the answer is you'd be cranking off thinking about her and not Le Pen.
I feel great. He's just Patty and Selma. You got a van you can throw an old broad into.
I gotta go change wigs.
I'm chilling in Cedar Rapids.
I may not be the mask, but I'm smoking.
There he is. I love that, like, Ross is never thirsty for, like, the way, like, David Brooks is, for instance, for hot younger women.
Yeah. Let me email that.
It's always for, like, these crones, like fucking Le Pen or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, he's like, What was that, a Simpsons joke where it's like, what, you don't think you don't think Eudora Welty is erotic? I find intellect and power sexy.
No, but sorry, Ross just had a follow-up to his "Is there a case for Le Pen" column, or like I said, if he had a fucking any editors there, the column would have just been titled "The Case for Le Pen." He follows it up that says, "In my Sunday column, I raised the possibility that a vote for Marine Le Pen in next weekend's French presidential runoff might be more defensible than a vote for Donald Trump in 2016. The internet did not agree, and perhaps neither did Le Pen herself, since she rewarded my controversial foray by immediately getting mired in a plagiarism scandal." Because it's like,
that's
the worst thing
you can do.
That's what's bad about her, is that she plagiarized a
when
speech.
You're a grade grubbing shithead, that is the worst.
That is true.
And I do like the idea that he took it personally. Like, you know, he sent her the note that said, "Do you like me? Circle yes or no."
Mademoiselle Le Pen, the American who looks like a thumb has endorsed you. We are going to win. Every French person loves Ross Douthat.
So yeah, I think that the point with Douthat over there again, like I said earlier, is just like, I don't know. It genuinely baffles me why anyone buys, like, this game he does where he plays, like I said, demure, or he, like, you know, he's just like doesn't show too much leg, you know, in any of his columns. But like, it's obviously what he believes in.
Yeah,
right?
It's like he's trying to coyly uncross his legs to show you a little bit, and a turd rolls out of his pants. That's how I would describe Ross's writing.
It's evocative.
That is quite an image. Yeah.
It's my ill-reviewed Basic Instinct remake. It's a little bit of a slapstick element.
Now I'm just thinking of the scene from Basic Instinct, but when she uncrosses her legs, it's just Ross's face.
Oh, I know, and I'm jacking off.
Moving on from Ross, again, another great New York Times columnist back in the news this week. Of course, I'm referring to David Brooks.
Yeah, put on Future Pussy Overrated. I won. That's David's theme song now.
So, what did David do?
David has taken a break from writing columns entitled "The Crisis of Western Civilization" to get married.
Oh, he's got married again. That's why the Future song. Yeah.
Mazel tov, David.
Yeah. Oh, so, you know, cheers to the happy couple. We mentioned this, Jacob, on the Jacob Bacharach episode back in Pittsburgh. He actually is now marrying. This was announced in the Washington Post wedding section. He is marrying his former research assistant from the book "The Road to Character," Ms. Ann Schneider, soon to be Mrs. Ann Schneider Brooks.
Hey, look, sometimes on the road to character, you run into some walls and you have to smash down the back of them.
We mentioned this before.
I'm just glad that he's getting married, because there was a while there where he was really a danger of, you know, becoming an opium addict or doing crime or alcoholism, you know. Yeah. Like, as we know, getting married is the solution to social ills. So he really dodged a bullet by
this is difficult for me. I like, the words are sticking in my throat, but I do have to say, Matt Iglesias had a funny tweet about this yesterday.
Sometimes he does.
I know,
that.
It was annoying.
Sometimes he does it.
So
I actually I don't think I hate him more than when he has a good tweet.
As Golden Meir says, the worst thing the terrorists make us do is retweet them, unironically.
I unironically retweeted Matt for the first time, Matty Iglesias rather, because he was quote tweeting the wedding announcement from the Washington Post, and he was like, maybe David can write a column about how poor people can find themselves in marriages like this. But, you know, David Brooks is, you know, upholding the time-honored bourgeois values of fidelity, humility, and hard work and thriftiness in marriage through his amazing wedding registry.
Oh, my God.
It has since been taken down, but for a brief, glorious moment yesterday, I was able to browse the David Brooks wedding registry. And at the beginning of it, it said, like, you know, thank you so much here. Like, you know, these are our selections. We accept these gifts in the spirit of community that it represents. And one of the gifts, and it made clear that this could be a family gift, was a $2,600 set of three plates that were, like, called foam plates. They were white and gold foam plates where, like, some of the edges looked like that awful microfoam that, like, dumb trendy restaurants have.
Yeah.
Hideous.
Well, rich people are so fucking boring.
It's amazing.
You spend $3,000 on everything, and you're like, I want some plates that cost a lot for some reason.
When I was scrolling through his wedding registry, it looked like a Williams and Sonoma catalog, and all I could think about is, like, the fucking Jonah Hill character from Wolf of Wall Street, who's just, like, the Jewish guy who just dresses like a wasp. Like, this is, like, the most boring wasp knockoff shit.
Yeah.
And the other funny thing, I was like, well, you know, it's his second marriage, her first. The second wife has to get something, and in this case, it's several Bobby Flay cookbooks.
Chintzy.
Look, I want that Le Creuset Dutch oven. Yeah. Those things are great, and like $600. Oh, another thing that was on the David Brooks wedding registry.
Sabian.
You mispronounced it too. It's Sibian.
Oh,
it's Sibian.
Oh,
okay.
Oh.
Sabian? Are you fucking kidding me?
What? What? No, that's how I've heard it said.
Sabian.
That's how I've heard it said.
God,
like,
damn it.
Football coach.
Nick Sabian. The Sibian wasn't on there, but one of those, like, plug in Hitachi magic wands, that was definitely on there. That's good shit. Also, on the David Brooks and Snyder wedding registry, the Cumtown Indoor $600 Vitamix is also on there. Yeah.
That's Brett Steven. Him and Brett Stevens got into an argument where David Brooks is like, you're fucking gay, dude. You copied me. I talked about getting the Vitamix first.
A little disappointed it's not a Juicero, I gotta say.
You know, this is the wedding registry is kind of interesting to me, the David Brooks thing, because it goes back to something I was thinking about Brett Stevens. Stevens and Brooks are interesting because they badly want to be European conservatives. They want to be like Peter Hitchens. They want to be in that tradition of the sort of downtrodden people with some sort of intellectual heritage, however fraught and bullshit it is.
They'll never be like Pitchens, though, because they can't allow themselves to just be utterly miserable and despondent.
Right, exactly.
They believe in happiness. That's
right,
the thing.
Right.
They
That's
like
the problem with them. They have that sort of American Protestant madness. But there is this neuroses among American establishment conservatives that they want to be that and never can be. And looking at the bullshit that he gets, it's like he's like, oh, what would a fancy guy get? And it's plates that cost a lot. And the Bobby Flay cookbooks.
Yeah. Peter Hitchens's registry, where he would just be like, just a bit of just toast, some marmalade.
Give me a toaster, boy. Give me a slave.
British treats.
A tombstone for our nation.
Yeah.
But with the American ones, you get this fucking yuppie bullshit.
They believe in happiness, and they believe that, like, happiness is like a moral value.
Protestant work ethic.
And they think that,
man,
like,
it's such a sad, pathetic, impoverished version of happiness.
Yeah, sure.
It's like having a big, shitty fucking McMansion in the middle of, like, rural Maryland and a bunch of matching plates. Jesus fucking Christ.
Yep.
It's like you read Nietzsche and it's like, you know, this last man sounds like he's got it pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, they're pull up your pants stuff. It's a little rooted in that, because whenever they talk about, like, who did they hate the most in the mid-2000s? It was Terrell Owens. He was sort of the public menace. And, you know, you could say it's because he promotes thug culture and he's ungrateful and blah, blah, blah. But really, it's because he was a rich guy who spent his money on cool shit, actually. It's the real reason they hate all that.
Yeah, that's why they hate rappers, basically. Like, that's why they scold black people mainly. It's just because, like, they seem like, or like celebrities. Just like they hate anyone who has money and spends it on anything other than playing fucking golf.
Yeah.
And just being a generally joyless, humorless prick. So that's David Brooks. Any further thoughts on the Brookses? But, you know, seriously, mazel tov to him and Schneider.
There was a funny again,
23 years his junior.
Yeah. Oh yeah?
Yeah.
How come everyone says it's fucked up when I try to date people that are 23 years younger than me? Leave it in.
Okay, it's your reputation.
I've said worse. I've said worse today.
But
no, I hope him and his shitty plates and his Vitamix and his wife, who he has literally nothing in common with and cannot carry a conversation with, and who endures sex with him when she allows it to happen with grim resignation, are very happy.
David Brooks doesn't fuck like a normal person. He puts his head into the vulva and just lists virtues. Honesty.
Either that or he fucks like a turtle. Like, you've ever seen video of like a tortoise trying to get it up?
Hell
like
yeah,
that.
Dude.
No, Matt, what happens?
Oh, it's great.
Yeah, well, they get on top. And then they do individual thrusts, and they make this really weird noise when they do it. They're like,
yeah, it's so funny. It's so fucking funny.
Yo, if you listen to this shit right now, yo, check out some of that turtles. Check out some of those turtles, yo.
Yeah, that's imagine David Brooks, his shiny fucking chrome dome doing that. His glasses are all fogged up.
And like I said, I opened this up. One of his most recent columns was literally titled "The Crisis of Western Civilization." And then I looked at his fucking wedding gift registry, and it was like the perfect fucking like it represents everything that is fucking like just decadent deserves to be wiped out in our fucking doomed culture.
That article ruled because his argument was is that the reason Trump won and the reason there's all the rise of this nihilistic populism is because colleges stopped teaching about the greatness of Western civilization.
Oh God!
Because you know every fucking dipshit who voted for Trump. You know, it's like I loved America until my semiotics instructor at Brown made me question American values. Get the fuck out of here. Most Americans don't go to college, you fucking dipshit.
All of America was like Tone and Carmella when AJ started reading Howard Zinn. And they're like, what the fuck you say?
This funny story of Chomsky. He went to the dentist. And the dentist said, you know, your teeth are all right, but you've got to stop grinding them. He said, I don't grind my teeth. He said, well, you do. The enamel is worn off. Well, I don't. So Mrs. Chomsky was there, and he asked, well, when he sleeps, does he grind his teeth? He said, no, he doesn't grind his teeth. Well, they both got terribly interested. When did it happen? Well, they finally found out that in the morning while having coffee, and she might be out of the room, he would start to read the New York Times, and his teeth would mine grind, too, when I read that paper, particularly the things they do to that scientist at Los Alamos, or their invention of the Whitewater plot. It's a bad paper.
Okay, should we move on to Rod?
I think we have no choice, but
we got to.
Yeah, let's fuck with some Rod, dude.
Classic.
Who should have a New York Times column.
Yeah, at least it would be surprising.
Doesn't. Yeah.
At least like
he
when I read,
he would blow fucking Ross out of the water.
Yeah.
Like the
because like Ross has a little bit of religious pathology and weirdness.
Yeah.
But it's not nearly as interesting or as catastrophic as Rod's.
No.
Should totally just bounce him and give Rod that spot.
Ezra Klein actually had some very earnest tweet where he was like, doing your fantasy like op-ed draft. Who are your top five?
Oh,
and like,
dude.
yo, Rod Dreher might be on mine because, like I said, at least he'd be surprising. That's on the theocratic right. On the left, I'm bringing in Bad Dominicana.
yeah, Bad Dominicana, Rod Dreher, Mike Cernovich.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think Avakian. You know, bouncing out
hell
the left.
Yeah.
And then I think right in the middle, Kevin Drumm.
I was going to say, get Ron back out of retirement.
Yeah, dude, it's time for Ron to ride again.
Yeah, he would be
Ron, the game needs you more than ever.
He would be the pivot. He would be the fulcrum that the teeter-totter would be balanced on. Ideological teeter-totter. By the way, I guarantee you that fucking question, who in a draft fantasy draft, your five New York Times columnists, that's something that Ezra says on all of his first dates.
Now I'm thinking about Rod, like, trying to synthesize between Bad Dominicana and Rod Dreher. And he's like, well, it's true that whites can't grow butt meat because their backs are too long. But it's also true that the collapse of virtues is leading to gender tyranny. But I think that if we could get Bad Dominicana and Rod together in a commune, we could figure this out.
So, like I said, yo, this is Chapo classic, man. Yeah. This is fucking this is old school Chapo. So we got to talk about Rod Dreher because man, oh man, The New Yorker had a gigantic profile of him the other week that fucking delivers.
Okay? One of the best things
I've fucking read. Delivers, okay? Like I said, if you're listening to this, you already know Rod. You already know we fucks with Rod Dreher heavy.
You know who it is.
You know the story. You already know who it is. But this is the New Yorker profile by Joshua Rothman, who, if you may remember, was the fucking rube who was so impressed by J.D. Vance. And man, oh man, he does this. He's even more impressed with Rod, if you can believe it. So this is a long one, and there's a lot to do, but fuck it. Let's just do it.
Yeah.
Because this is going to be fun.
Yep.
I'm just going to read now from the beginning. Rod Dreher was 44 when his little sister died. At the time, he was living in Philadelphia with his wife and children. His sister Ruthie lived in their Louisiana hometown outside St. Francisville, population 1,712. Dreher's family had been there for generations, but he had never fit in. As a teenager, when his father and sister went hunting, he stayed in his room and listened to the Talking Heads. He read A Movable Feast and dreamed of Paris. He left as soon as he could, becoming a television critic for the Washington Times and then a film critic for the New York Post. He was living in Cobble Hill on 9/11. It goes on, blah, blah, blah. He wrote a book called Country Cons. It's just, you know,
What's his favorite Talking Heads song? This isn't my bathroom.
This is not my beautiful life. This is not my beautiful wife. So it goes on to talk about, you know, he sort of moved away as soon as he can, but his sister stayed at home in, you know, Shits Parish Swamp, Louisiana. And he said, you know, his sister never really related to him, and she found him annoying. Imagine that. Mm. In truth, annoying wasn't the half of it. There was a rift between Dreher and his family. His father, a health inspector, had never forgiven him for moving away. His nieces found urbanity condescending. During one New Year's visit, Dreher made bouillabaisse for his parents and his sister. They watched him cook the stew and then let him serve it, then declined to eat any. They preferred meals made by a country cook. Later, Dreher learned that Ruthie and her husband were struggling financially and resented the fact that he made twice their combined salaries for reviewing movies. His father considered him a user, someone who succeeded by flouting the rules. Dreher loved his father and sister for their rootedness and vibrancy. He longed for their approval with painful intensity. So, okay, so like
his dad was also the inspiration for the title character in Larry the Cable Guy Health Inspector.
So here's this thing where, like, okay, so Rod, it was just sort of, you know, the outsider in his, like, you know, sort of conservative, rural Louisiana family. He feels guilty about it. You know, he was sort of artistic as a child, creative, if you will, and then got the hell out of there as soon as possible, moved to the big city, as a lot of people do. So then he talks about how his sister eventually, unfortunately, gets sick. And she dies, and he goes home and, like, experiences, like, the how rooted she was in her community and how beloved she was by everyone. And it says here, because Dreher is at once spiritually and intellectually reckless, his blog has become a destination for the ideologically bi-curious. A bad Dreher post can be mean-spirited and overwrought, but when he's at his best, his posts are unique, deeply confessional, achingly sincere, intellectually searching. The day after Ruthie died in September, Ruthie is his sister, the day after Ruthie died in September 2011, Dreher wrote a 2,700-word entry describing her funeral. Ruthie's funeral made him wonder about his own life in Philadelphia. He and his wife, Julie, had friends there and a rich cultural life, but it was impossible to replicate the deep roots his family had in St. Francisville, which seemed an illuminated place. The people there had an expansive, natural, spontaneous relationship to God that made his own faith feel intellectual and disembodied by comparison. So, like, there's this whole Rod thing where, like, he feels guilty that he got out of St. Francisville, which sounds like a fucking miserable place to live.
Yeah.
Like, his family wouldn't even eat food he prepared for him because that's how fucking backwards and cruel they are.
Yeah. This but is a good origin story for a villain so
yeah.
far.
Yeah.
I actually
yeah.
am quite compelled by it.
And, like, so, like, and he feels guilty because he has a good job and, like, friends and family and, like, you know, in a city or whatever. And he feels bad, so he moves home hoping to be, you know, received warmly by this faith community that he's been searching out his whole life. Would it surprise you to know that it didn't work out at all? This March, Dreher published The Benedict Option, a strategy for Christians in a post-Christian nation, which David Brooks in The Times has called the most discussed and important religious book of the decade. It asks, why
is that including Scott Adams's The Religion War?
Yeah. Brooks is full of shit if he hasn't read The Religion War. As a longtime reader of Dreher's blog, an experience alternately enthralling and exasperating, I'd always wondered what he'd be like in person. And now this is where I take issue with Rothman. If you are indeed a longtime reader of Dreher's blog, and he acknowledges it can be overwrought and at times exasperating, Joshua, why didn't you include any of the actual examples from Rod's blog? Because a New Yorker reader would read this entire profile and be like, oh, this sounds like an interesting and spiritually convicted man who's, searching for something deep and meaningful as community. What they won't find is what is at the top of Rod Dreher's actual blog at the American Conservative today, which is a write-up of the Alton Sterling verdict, the guy who was killed by the police in Baton Rouge last year, in which he lists his entire rap sheet and refers to him as, quote, Alton Sterling was a thug with a long criminal rap sheet, and goes on to just quote at length and just basically imply that the police did nothing wrong. He said, it's not racism, and it certainly isn't police brutality. Readers of the New Yorker will not find any quotes from any of the things we've fucking covered of Rod, which are his incredibly cruel and nasty things that he said about fucking gay people, trans people, literally calling them freaks, and these sort of diseased bodies
up insane fake stories to scare other
other bigots like himself.
Fucking rubes.
I mean, Rod Dreher's mind is just like a violent, terrifying hellscape. And this, a better writer would have been like, okay, here's this freak, how is he made? But this, it's like he's profiling Augustine. Who's this Rod?
So Joshua is very excited. He gets to meet Rod. And he says, I nearly didn't recognize him when we met earlier this spring at a Manhattan steakhouse. Without his glasses, Dreher, now 50, has an open, vulnerable, and strikingly handsome face. His graying beard and fashionably upswept haircut suggest a Confederate soldier in a historical drama. He wore black Chelsea boots and an oversized black leather jacket, and around his left wrist, a knotted prayer rope. Nice to meet you, brother, he said. He speaks slowly, quietly, with a soft Louisiana drawl that I'm sure is not at all affected or played up. Over dinner, Dreher, who was observing Lent, confined himself to oysters and crab cakes. I learned what happened
when... What a hard Lent. What is he giving up for Lent?
Steak?
Yeah.
I learned what happened when he moved back to St. Francisville. Rod says, the thing that I dreamed of and hoped for didn't work out. They just wouldn't accept me. Not my sister's kids and not my dad and mom. They just could not accept that I was so different from them. I worshipped my dad. He was the strongest and wisest man I knew. But he was a countryman, a southern countryman, and I just wasn't. All that mattered was I wasn't like them. It just broke me. He fell into depression and was diagnosed with chronic mono, then went into therapy and read Dante. But so he talks about his father and sister like they're saints and shit, but all of the color fucking assholes. I've been thinking a lot about my own longing for order, he said. I think it has to do with my dad. He was such a force. You saw the sun was in the sky in the morning because daddy had hung it there while he was making our honey buns and getting us ready for the school bus ride. Ray O'Dreher grew up so poor that his family hunted squirrels for food. He liked to build, repair, hunt fish, and his forearms were freckled from the sun. Again, Josh, how would Joshua Rothman know this? Did Rod give him these descriptions? Of his father's burly, freckle spackled arms.
Josh, if you're interested, I have an entire photo album of dad's forearms.
He said he raised Rod and Ruthie with a firm sense of right and wrong. When he saw or read about an alcoholic, a philanderer, a shoplifter, he said, as if stating a fact, that's not how we do things.
That doesn't at all sound like an unbearable Calvinist prick who everyone hates.
So can I ask a point of clarification? What was Rod's religion growing up?
It's just Baptist.
Sunni Islam.
Okay. It doesn't say, I assume Southern Baptist.
Because I know he's had a couple
I believe they were Yazidis.
Got it.
But the thing about this is okay, we can look at this guy and think, geez, this guy seems like a unpleasant shithead, and nobody should feel inferior for not living up to their weird expectations. But like Rod, like all of us, are brought up in a culture where all the people making culture are basically like Rod, in that they are the sensitive theater kids who left their shitty hometowns, and they are feeling, they'll always feel weirdly inadequate because of that, because of America's frontier ethos and what we think it means to be a man. Mm-hmm. And so this like just like hateful, closed off assholishness gets turned into rugged, taciturn masculinity and something to be chased after and placated instead of something to be rightly fucking walked away from.
Let me just say, we're not like that on Chapo Trap House. We think all men are swole.
Yep.
We think all men are alphas. We think all men have the gorilla mindset.
That's right.
We're male body positive.
Here's some more tales from Rod's youth. Once when Dreher was 7, he did something mean to his sister. He doesn't remember what. And his father told him it was time for a spanking. Dreher lay face down on the bed while his dad removed his belt. Then Rusi, who was 5, ran into the room and threw herself over him. She cried, "Whip me, Daddy, whip me." After a moment, Dreher's father and sister left. He remained on the bed, mystified by what had happened. He sometimes wondered if his sister's later wariness towards him flowed not from a divergence of values, but from some long-forgotten habit of childhood cruelty for which he was never punished.
Did you see the remake of Straw Dogs that took place in Louisiana
a
couple years ago?
I didn't.
Yeah, well, I did.
Okay. I think this is the transcript.
One more. When Dreher was 14, he went hunting with Ray and Ruthie, and with a shotgun, he killed 2 baby squirrels. Filled with remorse, he sat on the ground and cried. "You sissy," his father growled. Dreher describes his father and sister as, quote, Bayou Confucians. He explains, "They had this idea that if you did what you were supposed to do, you would succeed. I didn't do those things, but I didn't fail, and that drove them crazy." Again, these sounds like people you'd be fucking glad to cut out of your life.
Yeah.
If you fucking were successful. You'd be fucking thrilled not to have to deal with them
again.
Oh
my God.
It goes on to talk about, you know, it goes to college. He started out as sort of like left wing, but then he got religion, okay? For some reason, he had some weird part of his personality that presented some sort of gaping hole in himself that he felt the need to atone for, but also correct in himself. So he turned to religion.
Yeah.
The Catholic religion.
Yep.
Surprisingly.
Yep.
Usually that doesn't happen that way.
That.
But so it says here, he began to take religion seriously. When he was 18, he went to see Pope John Paul II at the Superdome in New Orleans.
Ooh, good line coming up.
The Pope appeared and a thought flashed in Dreher's mind. I wish he were my dad.
Oh my God.
Ooh, okay. At 26, he converted to Catholicism. Fed up with what?
If that had been his dad, he would have had a few other things to get over from his childhood.
Rod would have been getting a different type of Bayou Confucianism.
Whip me, El Papa.
Yeah.
Whip me. fed up. Okay, so he says at 26, he converted to Catholicism. Again, big shock for someone with his fucking.
Did not see that coming.
He said he converted to Catholicism, fed up with what he perceived as his own caddishness. He had once dated a girlfriend longer than he should have. He decided to embrace chastity until marriage. You know, just like how, you know.
This is regular guy shit.
You convert to Catholicism because you're fed up with your caddishness where you dated one girl and then just decided to be celibate until marriage. Okay, yes. Moving on.
Yeah.
Dreher left Catholicism in 2006. Okay, so this goes on here.
Yeah, then he became Orthodox.
He left Catholicism in 2006 because of the sexy covering the Catholic sex abuse scandal for the Post and the American Conservative. He became Eastern Orthodox. He met this guy, Father Matthew, in St. Francisville when he moved home and like became Orthodox, who told him, you have no choice as a Christian. You've got to love your dad, even if he doesn't love you back in the way you want him to. You cannot stand on justice. Love matters more than justice because the higher justice is love. When Dreher struggled to master his feelings, Father Matthew told him to perform a demanding Orthodox ritual called the Optina Rule. He cited the Jesus Prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner, hundreds of times a day.
All of this is just shit that people invented because they didn't know how to read or have TV. This is just bullshit. Like, this is so,
you know,
stupid.
Like, I have to say, like the Douthat episode we did, at this stage,
I am, you know, this is shitty to hear happening to a person.
Yeah.
And I can see, like, so far how he became what he is now from just this unrelenting and crushing insecurity that gets ripped open by all these religious and familial assholes.
Yeah, like it's a scab that I'll never hear and that he literally picks open every day on his blog at several thousand words a clip.
Yes.
Looking back on his time in St. Francisville, Dreher thinks that if he hadn't moved there and then forced himself to follow the rules, prayer, proximity, love, he would have stayed an angry child forever. Which is good because he's in no way he's childish or petulant now.
Yeah, he...
Thank God he fixed that.
No cruelty, spite, anything like that.
Obsessions.
Yeah, normal guy.
Like I said, the piece goes on, and Joshua goes to a Washington, D.C. book signing and Q&A session with Dreher, and I just like this little detail here where it says, he wrestles with his addiction to blogging and to Twitter and has covered the Apple logo on his laptop, which he calls My Precious, with a sticker of the Benedictine emblem. No logo, Rod.
There's a lot
of stuff here about where they visit this intentional, what is known as an intentional community. This place called Hyattsville, Maryland, that is sort of like a living example of these Benedict option communities that Rod talks about. Let me find it here.
Is that just a gay conversion therapy center?
It basically is. Yeah. So this is Hyattsville, Maryland, a small suburb of Washington, D.C. The community has no name. Residents just call it Hyattsville, but judging from the size of its two gendered listservs, barn raisers for men and Hyattsville Catholic women, around 200 Catholic families live there in modest brick homes with front porches. And so it's this like intensely Catholic community where like everybody like lives together in these kind of like this weird communal thing. And I was just, you know, reading the description of this community, and I was just thinking, T minus 5 minutes till something unspeakable emerges. Good about God. This shit. Like, well, you imagine.
In highly religious, closed off societies, there's never any problem where there's a clandestine group of men who invent some reason why they have to have sex with children. That never happens. That's why you actually do that to prevent that from happening.
Exactly.
I like this line here. It said, well, on the men's listserv, we talk about trading tools, one of the locals say, to general laughter. In a teacherly way, Dreher broke in. There's something very Benedictine about the simple things, like exchanging tools, he said.
That would be funny if, like, tools is a code word for child, and Rod just happened onto a community of pedophiles, and he's like, you guys remind me of the monk Theolosius. He left the Roman Empire, and they're like, What the fuck are you talking about? This, like, we're literally all pedophiles, Rod. We're not religious.
Speaking of Hyattsville, this is one of the residents says, if you want to be a little more private or isolated, then this might be a kind of difficult place to live. But that's the point of intentional community. I tell myself, I choose to be part of this. I want my neighbors to talk to me about their lives. Their conversation is a higher good.
I bet this community is great. Like, if you're a kid and you're gay or different in any way.
Literally any way. I bet you're going to have
a great upbringing. You'll grow up to be normal.
It's funny how Rod grew up among a bunch of like pinch-faced assholes who literally couldn't countenance anything that was even slightly different from the exact way that they believe and do things. It's good that, you know, he came up to see how bad that is and would never inflict that on other people.
A journey.
Yeah. The one way that I could get away from the thing that made me hate myself my entire life is the exact same thing.
Wait, so did he live in this?
No, he's visiting Hyattsville as part of his like book tour, because this is 200 easy book sales. Okay. Believe me. You basically have to read this book. People today, they want community without sacrifice, Dreher said. They want the good things, fucking having to make small talk with your miserable neighbors. Yeah, those are the good things. And they want to edit out the bad things, like, you know, the fact that your children may be abused by village elders. But you cannot have that closeness without being up in each other's business. The benefits come at a price. And again, like I said, in these intentional religious communities, that price is usually some sort of
sex crime,
unspeakable child abuse, or, you know, keeping women in a state of basically illiterate domestic servitude.
Yeah.
continuing here. Now he's back in New York, and he's talking. They're back in New York City.
Back in the New York groove.
And he's talking to some cool, young, Ben-op Catholics in New York. I just want to read this description of this couple.
They live in a water tower on the top of the Chrysler.
I just want to read this description. She was 27, worked for an altruistic for-profit, and wore a t-shirt advertising the Metaphysical Transit Authority. He was 24, sported a bow tie, and worked as an editorial assistant for First Things.
Cool.
Wouldn't you like them to have be your neighbors?
I love nothing more than an altruistic for-profit. Those are the best.
So it goes on. Here's sort of like the where Rothman sort of like in this is a little bit of a turn here. Like we've been building to this. Obviously, if you me reading this, I could see this coming a mile away. Anyone else, probably, if you're like maybe mildly aware, you can see what's coming. I'm reading from Rothman here. He says, toward the end of our time together, I told Dreher that his life story seemed very similar to those of many gay men I knew. He had grown up in the South.
What?
He had grown up in the South with a hypermasculine father who found his sensitivity and difference alienating. He had gone away to find himself and since then had struggled for a place in the world he left behind. Surely, I said, he must have some sympathy for gay Christians. And yet Dreher is certain that gay marriage is wrong. Like many Orthodox Christian intellectuals, Dreher holds labyrinthine views on homosexuality. He is opposed to same-sex marriage, but in favor of civil unions. In principle, he is against gay adoption, but in practice, he told me, there are so many gay couples who are wonderful parents, I find it hard to maintain any ardor for stopping it. Oh, how nice of him.
Very generous.
Gay marriage in this account, and then he goes on to say, this is his critique of gay marriage, which is like, it's inscrutable to anyone with a mind from this century. He says, gay marriage in this account is a stepping stone to a profoundly technologized society in which the rejection of nature is complete. Today, it's sex reassignment surgery and surrogacy. Tomorrow, we'll be genetically engineering our way into a post-human future. Okay. What I want to say about this is, like, you could tell from the first paragraph of this fucking article about how he spent his time listening to the Talking Heads while his dad was watching football, and then he went to the big city to become an arts critic. Okay. We've, like, okay, like, this has been the joke about Rod for basically as long as he's been doing the show, that his, like, again, very intense obsession with the gay agenda and the actual physical act of homosexual sex is, you know, in my opinion, fairly obviously signaling something deep inside himself that he's trying to deal with. Now, I bring this up because I think in the past someone criticized us in the show before. I think perhaps rightly so. And the way we talk about like the homophobia of a certain type of right-wing intellectual, making it seem like it's all part of like homophobia is just an extension of their twisted sexual pathologies and their sort of closeted self-loathing. And I think that's a valid criticism because that's not what homophobia is. Homophobia is, you know, something that is omnipresent in American culture. It is, if you are a man in this culture, it's something that you're steeped in, whether you're aware of it or not. It is not specifically the province of self-loathing closet cases, sure. And it shouldn't be presented as such.
A cousin to misogyny.
Yeah, homophobia is a cousin to misogyny, which is like a very heterosexual thing. Like that is like the most common manifestation of homophobia.
But.
But
Stephen A. Smith voice. But let me address. No, but I'm sorry. There is a very real thing about this certain kind of right wing intellectual who makes human sexuality like their 100% main focus. And that, I'm sorry, is Rod Dreher. That is unmistakable to anyone with eyes in their fucking head. And I don't think it should be beyond the pale to bring it up.
And it's not to even say that he's gay. It's like, who knows what he's repressing? He probably doesn't even know. He could be.
He's like fucking Troy McClure.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I'm going to SeaWorld.
I mean, he could be. We made the joke before that he should have been born like now because he could have been a Tumblr kid and found out. Maybe he's just asexual.
Right.
Maybe it's just that. No one knows, but it's some deviation from the norm that he sees as his father. And his entire life is just telling people what to do, how bad they are, but specifically in the act of penetration.
And disgust with them
whether they're trans or gay, because unlike him, they haven't solved the problem. And it's an insult to him. Like, I got over this, and you're being accepted and loved and taken care of by all these people, despite having, you know, not taken the brave journey that I did and becoming a fucking psycho.
And what pisses
and
me
off... That's why the argument, well, you can't choose to be gay or anything, or trans or whatever... It's never going to move a guy like that, because he's thinking, yeah, you fucking do.
Right.
I choose every fucking day to be straight. Okay, buddy?
And, like, there's a lot of these people on the right. Like, there's that guy Robbie George. There's that guy Ryan T. Anderson. And they get these glowing profiles about, like, again, these people who are incredibly spiteful, nasty ghouls. And they get glowing profiles in places like the Washington Post and elsewhere that all comport to this, like, fucking template. Ryan T. Anderson is, like, you know, young, you know, charming, you know, is a voracious, you know, reader, lives alone and plays the harpsichord, you know, like, that's like his main interest. It's like this very, like, they're, and I think the writers even know it, and they're just, like, edging up to it, but they can't fucking say it. Or just, like I said, I don't know if these people are, like, actually gay or, like, have homosexual desires or not, but, like, they conform to a stereotype of gay men in a way that is very obvious.
They are obsessed with it.
And that's all they write about. They've chosen to make gayness, like, the main focus of their, like, conservative policy research. I'm sorry, like, you know... That's a tell. I'm sorry.
And when these guys talk, they're obsessed with the act of penetration.
It fits, a penis fits in an ass like a baby, a fist fits in a man. Baby's
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I forgot about that.
Yep.
Chris is actually don't throw Walther in with this bunch. I think his psychosis is of a different
drunk,
nature.
Yeah,
he's drinking the pain away. That's for sure. Yeah. He's got a deep seated rage and fucking hatred in himself of himself. I should say. Yeah. So, like, yeah, I mean, like, with Rod, it's just like, who hurt you? And now we know it's his shitty family.
Yeah,
and, like, I just think it sucks that he's now, like, he's dedicating his life to hurting other people, as we've documented, and as fucking Rothman, if he wasn't such a fucking sponge and just sopped to this bullshit, would have let the New Yorker readers know just how fucking nasty and cruel Rod really is.
Same thing he did with J.D. Vance. None of the shitty parts of his biography or of his ideology got into that glowing review of how he's the hillbilly whisperer.
And like I said, I think it's important for us to make this distinction about, like, homophobia, like, isn't just a province of, like, this weird class of, like, intellectual weirdos, that it's a very prevalent and common thing in American society. And it's awful. Like, it's just like, it, like if you are, like, if you're gay, like, growing up, where, like, it's just like the standard idea is just that, like, you are wrong and alien in some way, and that it takes people, like, a long time to get over it, and you shouldn't have to. And it is this way largely because of people like fucking Rod and Ross and fucking David Brooks and all the rest of these fucking assholes who people like the New Yorker and the New York Times want to play nice with, instead of fucking just saying, bye. We don't need your point of view. It's not enriching our intellectual lives to, you know, hear your insane thoughts on why normalism versus realism in a metaphysical universe. And, you know, we're going to be have fucking manimals soon if, you know, gay people are allowed to adopt kids. And it's just like, no, this is just an intellectual excuse for cruelty and spite against people you have no fucking business or reason to fucking even deign to open your mouth about. Shut the fuck up. Keep it to yourself.
If Abu Bakar al-Baghdadi put on fucking horn rims and a little stupid bracelet, he would get a profile just like this. It's the same thing. It's the exact same fucking thing.
I just want to read one last item that I highlighted from the Rod piece. This is apropos of nothing, but I thought it was a hilarious sentence. This is at the Union League Club in Midtown. This is another book event full of hip-looking conservative Manhattanites and Orthodox priests. A nice mixture. Also, in sober suits and headscarves, men and women from the Bruderhof, a vowed community in upstate New York, stood on the fringes of the crowd behind tables stacked with copies of their magazine, Plow. Get your subscription to Plow right now, people.
Just a bunch of normal folks. Very normal.
I will say, though, one thing that actually was interesting and does come across in this article about Rod and a lot of these like intentional Christian communities that Orthodox and were deeply religious Christian communities that he talks about. One thing that I found was interesting is how they all acknowledge that capitalism is evil and a problem in a way that, as we've talked before, like evangelical Christians absolutely don't do. Right. Like they've wedded Christianity to capitalism in a way that, you know, nobody remarks upon, and they don't see any conflict. I did think it was interesting to hear from a lot of these like very intensely sort of like this communal, like old style, is that they very much do regard modernity as the enemy, but they understand that capitalism is the force that is destroying their way of life.
Even those people can figure it out.
It's the Tradcath mindset.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, it's like the libertarian thing where I go, hey, you're non-interventionist too. And then they're like, but also an esports team should be able to take over Iraq. And I'm like, oh, well, okay.
So, like I said, this whole episode, I mean, the theme is just stop believing that these people are your friends. Stop believing that, like, by, you know, playing nice with them, that you're engaging in some sort of intellectual weightlifting that will make your arguments better and perhaps have them examine their own prejudices. They won't. I think of one line that's always stuck with me from Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose. I'm not going to quote it exactly, but the line was, the difference between the powerful and the poor is that the power have the gift of knowing who their enemies are. And that always stuck with me. So keep that in mind. Know who your enemies are. They certainly do. And they're fucking conning you every time they're getting over on you every fucking day. And it's your own fault. And we're all going to suffer as a result of it.
Subscribe to the New York Times for Michael Barbaro's new article.
It's just Steve Mikey. Bannon,
yeah.
Mikey's
the best.
Better yet, don't subscribe to the New York Times, but do subscribe to Michael Barbaro's podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
That shit is fire, yo. Shit is fire.
Damn, son, where'd you find this? Dangerous, when he talks, unacceptable.
When he talks about how the Starbucks on 32nd Street is too stingy with the sweetener, it's amazing.
I love him. The one weird side effect of doing this show is developing actual affection just through rote reference to them for these dumbasses, and Mikey is one that I now genuinely like.
It's like being a sniper. Like, you watch your targets long enough. And you're like with Michael, I'm like, now I'm like, I used to be so mad at him for
like
some
Ron,
reason.
Like, Ron, if you listen to really early episodes, we just shit on Ron. We go, ugh. And then it's like, it's just little, by the time Virgil first came on, you guys are like, no, we actually kind of love Ron. And now we all really like him and think he's a good dad and like miss him.
A great person.
Yeah, like, I got to say, though, that's not going to happen with Ross.
No, hell no.
I could look down the scope at them for a week and still fuck you.
I don't like any of
them. You're a misanthrope.
Yeah.
I guess so, because like I just have nothing but contempt for all of them.
Not even Ron?
Like fucking Michael Barbaro and his stupid fucking Hunger Games beard.
Mikey Barbaro, I got the same dream every night. I see the ghosts of everybody I've owned on the podcast. They got black eyes because the 8-ball hemorrhage from when I put my tweet in. They're looking at me, and I go, what do you want from me? Anyway,
we should get him on the show.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, we should.
Podcast
or
Brothers.
Or go on his show.
Yeah.
Podcast.
What, Al Pacino? Yes. Yeah.
Welcome to the Pacino Podcast. Stamps.com.
I would love to, if you know Al Pacino or his people, have Al come on the show. We want to do a cruising episode.
He's honestly done way worse projects than ours.
A Righteous
Jack
Kill?
And Jill. He was like the third lead in Jack and Jill. It wasn't even like a cameo. Yeah. It was astounding. He's in that movie for half the runtime.
They're
mind-blowing.
There are cold opens that me and Brendan have written in literally like 2 minutes that are better scripted than the last 5 Al Pacino
That's
movies.
You saying that. I would never say that. I respect the man.
I'm negging him.
I'm trying to get him on the show. Okay, you neg him. Yeah. Good cop, bad cop.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like in Righteous Kill.
Exactly. Full circle.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, let's put a bow on this Chapo Classic episode, and we've just tamped down the dirt on just three full graves at the moment. I love it. Till next time, fellas.
Bye.
Bye.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.